It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, for as long as there has been a republic, our republic, American presidents have been granting pardons. George Washington, our very first president, granted the very first presidential pardon to men convicted in the so-called Whiskey Rebellion. This hour, we want to explore the origins and history of presidential pardons. And we have two esteemed guests with us to do that, very well informed about this topic. Presidential historian Tim Walsh is with us, Director Emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Tim, welcome back to our program.
Glad to be with you.
And our political scientist, Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, professor of political science there in Des Moines at Drake, normally on our Politics Wednesday. But Rachel, thank you for joining us for this special historical look back.
Well, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
And Rachel joining us via Skype today. Well, let's, before we get into, and there are a scad of very interesting stories stretching back through the history of our country, but I'd like to have you both talk a little bit about the origins of pardons and commutations. They're in our Constitution, Tim.
Yeah, absolutely. Article 2, I think Section 2, Clause 1 says that a president is able to pardon or commutate sentences for federal crimes. And that's the most important thing to remember. So it's written into our Constitution. And as you suggested, it starts with George Washington making the first commutation, or pardon, I should say, for treason and rebellion against the new federal government by people who were making whiskey in western Pennsylvania, did not want to pay a tax. So going forward, this is a longstanding American tradition.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, what is the difference between a pardon and a commutation?
Well, a pardon is basically eliminating a conviction. It's clemency for a conviction. I shouldn't say eliminating, because the party is still guilty, and that remains in place. But anytime after imprisonment or conviction of a crime, the president has the power to grant a pardon. And that means basically that the convicted is admitting guilt, unless the president explicitly states otherwise, and the person is allowed to leave prison. And they retain restore their voting rights and their right to serve on a jury and other privileges of democratic citizenship. And the other form of clemency that the president can give is called a commutation. And a commutation is basically a lessening of a sentence. It doesn't cancel the conviction. It doesn't restore voting rights and other democratic privileges.
Mm-hmm. Are there, Tim, are there any limits here? Can the president, you said federal
crimes.
Federal crimes, but are there any other boundaries here?
Well, obviously, a person can refuse a pardon. A pardon is deemed by law to be something of a gift. And in fact, we did have a case in 1829 where a man named George Wilson said, I don't wish to be pardoned. I was not guilty. I refuse to accept the fact that I have to accept my guilt.
Oh.
And so he stayed in prison actually until I think he was hung. So the truth is, although almost anyone would accept a pardon if given, it is, as Rachel suggests, the Burdick decision in 1915, which said, any person who accepts a pardon implicitly admits that they are guilty, so that that they were guilty of that crime and that they've been pardoned. So it's not expunged. They've been pardoned for their guilt and can go forward with the rest of their lives. A commutation cannot be refused. It's essentially the end of the sentence. The sentence might be shortened. So in certain cases, if somebody's in prison and requests a commutation, and it's, I think, more common than actual granting of pardons, a commutation for time served. They then receive that. And again, it's for a federal crime. So if they've committed a murder or a state crime, they cannot be pardoned or commutated by the president of the United States.
And governors as executives of their respective states. Yeah. Rachel, why don't you talk about that? Because we have state crimes and governors have a similar role in states, right? The governor of Iowa and so forth.
This is commonly thought to be an executive power. So under state justice systems, the executive of the state, that is the governor, would have similar powers, but it would be defined by a state constitution. The president exercises the pardon power for the federal criminal justice system or civil justice system.
Mm-hmm. Tim, why give an executive, why give our chief executive of the United States this power, alone this power? No one else has this power.
No, and if you look at the Federalist Papers, which was the explanation of why the founders added all of these elements and articles in our Constitution, what essentially, I think it's Alexander Hamilton who wrote in the Federalist Papers, that this was an effort or to give to the President of the United States an ability to address questions of grievance and tension among and between people who might differ and to give a certain generosity, a forgiveness within the Constitution to the President of the United States to kind of ease tension. So the idea is to say, well, there are people who were convicted of treason and who are being held in prison, but they have followers and others who believe that that was unfair or unjust. And after a certain period of time, we can set that aside and allow that person to go free and to rebuild their lives. So it is a sense of compassion in a way built into our government. And through tradition, we've applied that also to our governors. So, apropos of what Rachel was saying, I want people to think of those many films that they've seen where somebody is on death row and waiting at the last minute for the commutation or for the pardon from the governor. So it is a sort of a sense of justice is both merciful and appropriate to a crime. And so in that sense, what this pardon power does is it allows the president to make that decision. The question is, how does he make that decision and for whom does he apply the pardon or the commutation? And that's where there has been a certain amount of controversy within the political system. Who gets it?
Before we get into some of the most notable stories throughout history, Rachel, anything else to mention about the origins or the thinking, the justification for this, where the framers, why the framers put this in Article 2 of the Constitution?
Well, sure. I mean, as Tim mentioned, right, the Federalist Papers are very clear that this is meant to be used in cases of, quote, unfortunate guilt, which is kind of an odd turn of phrase that Hamilton uses, but also a recognition that sometimes the justice system will result in unfair outcomes, and similarly, a recognition that the country as a whole, right, that this plays a role for the country as a whole in kind of mitigating tension, creating opportunities for reconciliation. One of the interesting things about this power, if you go through the Constitution, of course, we all sat down and we studied checks and balances and separation of powers and what have you. There are very few powers that are given to the president that can be exercised unilaterally. Mm-hmm. That is, there are no checks that are specifically provided for in our constitutional structure. This is one of those very few instances where the framers gave unilateral power to the president.
Okay. If you've just joined us, so Rachel Payne Caulfield is with us via Skype, professor of political science at Drake University. Tim Walsh, director emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum, presidential historian. We're glad to have them with us to give us some context. Pardons, commutations have been in the news, not just this year, last year, but pretty much every year of our republic. Right?
Absolutely.
And so let's get into some of these stories. Tim, let's go to you. We mentioned at the outset that our very first president, George Washington, granted a pardon.
A new republic, and the question is, would those states and the individuals within those states, citizens of those states, respect the federal government? And so the question was with, I think it was whiskey distillers in the western part of Pennsylvania, perhaps are more moonshiners in western Pennsylvania, who were, in effect in rebellion against the federal government, and then they were charged. I don't have the specific details, but basically they were granted a pardon for their crimes. And in a way, in a new republic like this, Washington, I think, saw this as a way to calm a lot of the tension between the western parts of the new country and the east. So that was the first pardon, and it became something of a precedent. But there have been pardons of less notoriety since the first, and going forward, each of our presidents has made an effort to pardon some people. often they receive those, as I say, as a letter that would come to the White House and a particular appeal. And so in that sense, it would be an effort to rectify or to show compassion for people who've been, as Rachel said, unfortunately convicted of a crime.
Mm-hmm. And at one point, it's more formalized. It becomes an office of what?
The Office of the Pardon Attorney, of course. By 1870, the numbers approach hundreds and then thousands of people applying for pardons or commutations of their crimes. And so we have to have, let's put it this way, it became a burden for the White House to continue to write individual letters pardoning or commutating a sentence. And so you have an Office of a Pardon Attorney. I think first it's independent or maybe perhaps in the State Department, but then becomes part of the Department of Justice and is formalized in 1894. And in fact, if people are curious about the whole process, they can go to the website of the Office of the Pardon Attorney, which currently exists. In fact, there's 14 pages of frequently asked questions that people who are seeking pardons. So there's no shortage of people. And in fact, in the Obama administration, perhaps people thought that President Obama was particularly compassionate because the number, I mean, normally the any one administration, it's 3,000 or 4,000 requests for a commutation or a pardon, clemency, they call it. But in the Obama administration, it jumped to like 35,000 requests for commutation. So occasionally, just the number seemed to rise in perhaps proportion to people's individual interest in a particular president.
Okay. We've got sort of a great foundation to talk about presidential pardons and commutations, and that first one from George Washington. So with the remainder of the hour, as we learn more about presidential pardons and how different presidents have treated them, I'd just like to invite you, Rachel, and Tim to grab off the shelf a pardon that you see as notable or controversial and talk about it a little bit. And Rachel, let's turn to you first of all. Where do you land? It doesn't necessarily need to be chronological at this point.
Well, I think there are so many possibilities here. For example, obviously the one that most people go to is President Ford's pardon of President Nixon. And one of the really interesting things about this case, obviously it points to, first of all, the role of the pardon in that reconciliation process, as Ford specifically mentioned as he actually delivered the pardon. But it also, I think, points to an important fact about a pardon. Remember that in the case of Nixon resigned before any formal charges were filed. Mm-hmm. And so in this case, it's a proactive pardon. It's a pardon with no specific crime or conviction at hand.
Okay, so let's go back to September 8th of 1974, President Gerald Ford announcing his pardon of Richard Nixon to a televised television audience from the Oval Office. Ford's pardon spanned Nixon's entire term in office. Let's listen.
Finally, I feel that Richard Nixon and his loved ones have suffered enough and will continue to suffer no matter what I do, no matter what we as a great and good nation can do together to make his goal of peace come true. Now, therefore, I, Gerald R. Ford, President of the United States, pursuant to the pardon power conferred upon me by Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, have granted, and by these presents do grant, a full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon for all offenses against the United States which he, Richard Nixon, has committed or may have committed or taken part in during the period from July 20, 1969 through August 9, 1974.
Okay, Gerald Ford speaking in September of 1974. I was a very young individual at that time, but I do remember this Tim Walsh. This was very controversial.
It was extremely controversial. As we've said, Rachel suggested too as much that pardons can be controversial because of the notoriety of the person being pardoned. And at that point, when Gerald Ford took what many consider courageous, others consider despicable, the action of pardoning Richard Nixon, the country was divided over whether or not we should pursue justice against Richard Nixon or whether we should, for the good of the country, pardon him. And President Ford chose that path, and it had direct political consequences for him. Because in most cases, presidents are pardoning individuals, particularly notorious individuals, at the very end of their second term or their last term, usually on the last day, in fact, of their term, and rarely do they do a public address the
way that they can they suffer no consequences.
Well, they suffer no political consequence because, of course, there are still people who will argue, and maybe Rachel wants to weigh in, whether this particular act, more specifically than anything else, and there was terrible inflation and other things in the Ford administration— Yeah. But this particular act was what basically tipped the balances toward Jimmy Carter in the election of 1976 and lost the election for Gerald Ford, because people still held a grievance against Richard Nixon for his crimes against the country, and that Ford was sort of complicit by granting that pardon.
Mm-hmm. Rachel?
Yeah, I mean, at the time, you have to remember, right, Richard Nixon was not just notorious, but was so politically polarizing. But, you know, by one public opinion poll at the time, more Americans responded Richard Nixon when they were asked who the most evil person in U.S. history was.
Really?
Than selected the devil.
Really? Wow.
Yes.
Okay.
Richard Nixon, Watergate was such a critical moment for this country. And Nixon, you know, who had always had a certain self-presentation that invited scorn among his critics, he was not a particularly, you know, open, friendly, relatable guy to a lot of people who were inclined to dislike him at the outset, just for his political party and his political positions. Nixon was seen as this kind of critical moment at a critical moment in U.S. history where there was no, you know, so much of the country felt as though we were losing our very foundational values, mm-hmm. and Watergate was just a horrible, horrible stain on the history of the country. And so to pardon him, I mean, that was a huge step by Ford. Ford clearly saw it as a way to get beyond this moment, but it also mired him in that moment for a long time in the minds of a lot of Americans.
Okay. What's important here, too, is that as far as I know, Richard Nixon never requested the pardon. So, in effect, he never admitted that he was guilty of the crimes for which he was being pardoned. Now, implicitly, by accepting the pardon, he accepted his guilt, but he never said it. And you recall going forward, he tried to rebuild his post-presidential career and then doing those Nixon-Frost interviews, yes, where he said, in effect, well, if the president does it, it's legal. In effect, that pardon gave him a certain structure and a conceit to say nothing really happened here. It was unjust. And so you get that political manipulation sometimes post-pardon that I think further angered the American people. They would have, I think, accepted the pardon more fully had President Nixon said, yes, I committed a terrible crime against the American people, and I request a pardon from the President of the United States. Ford, you know, in effect, as Rachel suggests, anticipated tension and wanted to get past it almost for his personal political career, and it somewhat backfired against him in the process by giving it to President Nixon.
We have about 3 or 4 minutes before we have to take a break with Tim Walsh and Rachel Payne Caulfield talking about presidential pardons and commutations. Let's pick another one out of the basket. Tim, it's your turn. Where are you going with this?
Well, I'm going back to 1868. So, folks, a spoiler alert, we don't have Andrew Johnson on Christmas Day of 1868 talking about commutating and actually pardoning all of the soldiers of the Confederacy. I mean, when we talk about trying to relieve tension, there's no question that in the years immediately after the Civil War, there were still a lot of raw feelings about what had taken place in the previous 4 years and the tens of thousands of men who had lost their lives to protect the Union. But Andrew Johnson, who was from Tennessee and a Democrat of the other party, it was a fusion ticket in 1864, and of course becomes president on the death of Abraham Lincoln, chooses to pardon all of those who had served in the War of Rebellion against the United States. Now, the problem there in part, first of all, it was an act of compassion. There's no question about that. But to some extent, it also lays the groundwork for the Jim Crow era and the in effect rise of the South and the idea of white supremacy, that this was a noble cause, and really continues the war, at least implicitly, for another century. So that, in effect, by not saying all of those soldiers who fought against the United States as soldiers of the Confederacy were guilty of treason, which in fact they were, we created a noble cause, which then, as time goes on, leads to the tensions that we've had in recent times over statues and whether you adulate people like Thomas Jackson, Stonewall Jackson, or Robert E. Lee. These were traitors against the federal government, but we never prosecuted them because, of course, they were pardoned by Andrew Johnson.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. 90 seconds before a break, approximately, Rachel, anything to comment on there? So we really get to the motives that presidents have for pardons. Is it for the good of the nation? Is it for their own political self-interest? Is it to repay a debt? I guess it could be any of those things.
It could be any of those things or anything else. As a unilateral power of the presidency, there have always been norms surrounding the use of the pardon in terms of the specific circumstances under which a pardon would be more or less acceptable and politically acceptable in particular. Legally, it's a unilateral power, so the president can do whatever he wants. But certainly kind of the idea that presidents do this as a way to heal the nation after a particularly devastating or difficult time period has been historically one of the guiding reasons for the pardon power.
Okay, we'll be back in just a few minutes. Rachel Payne Caulfield of Drake University, Tim Walch, presidential historian, director emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. When we come back, we'll find out what Tim and Rachel have to point out. There are so many on our list of notable controversial pardons. We won't have time for all of them. So in the short break here, they'll be looking through their notes and coming up with more notable controversial pardons as we look back in history at this unique executive power of the President of the United States. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, today with Rachel Payne Caulfield of Drake University, where she's professor of political science, Tim Walch, director emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum, presidential historian. We love to have both of these team up, and they have teamed up in the past to talk about, we've got such a unique president. The way this series started is this president breaks a lot of norms, does a lot of things that previous presidents haven't. So we've then been looking at the ways that past presidents, in historical perspective, how past presidents have behaved and done certain things. This case, we're looking at presidential pardons and commutations in historical perspective. At the end of this hour, we'll have a brief mention, talk a little bit about the real departure that the current occupant of the White House has made regarding pardons and commutations. Tim Walch, Rachel Caulfield, I think it's Rachel's turn. We're sort of ping-ponging back and forth to have you pick out notable/notorious/controversial pardons. Rachel, it's in your court, I think.
Yes. Well, so we've been talking until now. Our notable ones have been about healing the nation. I'm going to go with the unfortunate justice angle here for an individual. also an example of the fact that the pardon and commutation are not an either-or scenario. So Jimmy Carter commuted the sentence of Patty Hearst, and then Bill Clinton went on to pardon Patty Hearst. And Patty Hearst, of course, the granddaughter of William Randolph Hearst, who was kidnapped and subsequently went on with the Symphony's Liberation Army, went on to commit a series of crimes, was convicted and imprisoned. And both presidents felt that she had done the time and it was an unfortunate situation. And so, interestingly, Carter commuted the sentence and President Clinton pardoned.
Mm-hmm. And it strikes me that in some of these pardons that we're mentioning at the time, and also in our
this
current
times. This is notorious.
Yeah. That some of them are really under the radar. You're like, this person is pardoned? Who is that? Patty Hearst was on how many front pages for how long? How many years?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Right. this was a notorious episode in American history.
In fact, she drifts into some of the lyrics from Warren Zevon. Lawyers, Guns, and Money. I mean, you know, that when you become a part of somebody's song lyric, you know you're a celebrity among special celebrities.
Okay.
That's right.
Any other words for about Patty Hearst before we move on?
She heard the burst from Roland's Thompson gun. You know, that's the line.
Tim Walsh, a man of many talents.
We're gonna, really?
Have you get out your guitar maybe later?
Not. I have no guitar to bring here.
Who is on your list now?
Well, on my list is, I'm going to invoke something I think that is new to River to River, and that is a discussion of pirates. Because the pirate Jean Lafitte was pardoned by President James Madison for having served admirably during the War of 1812 along with Andrew Jackson. Now, he had been convicted of smuggling, as all pirates do. I think it's a law. I think they're required to smuggle. At any rate, he was convicted of federal crime of smuggling, but then later, because of his service to the nation, was pardoned for his crime. So on behalf of all those out there, I'll just say, arg, and we'll go on. But yes, there is some, I suppose, history does offer a certain measure of levity, and it was a surprise to me when I discovered that Jean Lafitte had been exonerated and pardoned by President James Madison.
It's pretty hard to top. Pretty hard to top, Rachel. What about?
Really? Well, I got to say, though, it's a perfect pirate name.
It is.
Rachel, following on the heels of pirates or their peg legs.
Yeah.
I don't know what you want to say, but yeah.
Another group pardon. Truman went ahead and pardoned 1,523 individuals who were convicted under the Selective Service Act for refusing draft service. Hmm. Most of them were conscientious objections for religious reasons. And so Truman decided that for the good of the nation and to recognize sincerely held religious belief in this circumstance, that he would go ahead and pardon them.
And these would have been men, I assume men who refused to serve in the Second World War.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I wanted to turn to one. We have a little bit of audio of this one that we really bring it to contemporary times. Barack Obama commuting a sentence, which we will remember no matter what age we are, because it happened in 2017. I'll have you talk about this, but let's listen to this. During his final press conference in January of 2017, President Barack Obama was asked about his justification of commuting the sentence of Chelsea Manning, given the timing of the WikiLeaks investigation, Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. Here's President Obama, then President Obama, January of 2017.
Let's be clear. Chelsea Manning has served a tough prison sentence. So the notion that the average person who was thinking about disclosing vital classified information would think that it goes unpunished, I don't think would get that impression from the sentence that Chelsea Manning has served. It has been my view that given she went to trial, that due process was carried out, that she took responsibility for her crime, that the sentence that she received was very disproportionate relative to what other leakers had received, and that she had served a significant amount of time, that it made sense to commute and not pardon her sentence.
Okay, President Obama reflecting on justifying in his final press conference in January of 2017 the pardoning of Chelsea Manning. Chelsea, an American activist, a whistleblower, convicted by court-martial in 2013 of violations of the Espionage Act and other offenses. She was the one who disclosed to WikiLeaks nearly what hundreds of thousands of classified, unclassified, sensitive military information. Rachel, your comment on this particular pardon?
Well, this is clearly one of those examples where the president was looking to kind of that unfortunate guilt question, right? And the idea that once you've served time, you've served time. And in his opinion, and the Constitution gives him every authority to use his opinion, in his opinion, the time she had served was enough time. And so this is something that, you know, we see frequently when individuals who have kind of have been convicted, but it's an area of the law that has not been well settled at the time. And so sometimes the opinion is that the sentence is long and it's time to recognize that this person is has done their time and pardon them.
Right. All right. Rachel Caulfield with us, if you've just joined us, of Drake University, Tim Walsh. Presidential historian Tim, back in your court for, as we sort of, you know, this has kind of evolved over time, and you're bringing up cases that kind of get us light into some dark corners and why things have evolved the way they have been in pardon. So what is your next case?
Well, I'd like to, first of all, to pick up a variation from what Rachel suggested, because, of course, she was discussing Chelsea Manning. There was nothing for Barack Obama to gain by pardoning or I guess commutating the sentence of Chelsea Manning. And in fact, there was some potential controversy, much like Gerald Ford. There's no personal gain in pardoning Richard Nixon. I'd like to talk about those that were perhaps tarnished in part because of the close friendship or association to the president. And I'm going to pick up on the ones that Bill Clinton did on the last day of his second term, mm-hmm. where he pardoned Mark Rich, who was a financier whose wife had made a substantial donation to his future presidential library. So that smacks of inappropriate pardoning, let's put it that way, and that was quite controversial. He also pardoned his half-brother, Roger. Some people will remember Roger Clinton, and of course, there's a burden that family members have when their sibling becomes president of the United States. Remember, Billy Carter is another one. Roger Clinton was guilty of, dealing drugs, and so he was pardoned for his crimes. And then Susan McDougal, who was a close family associate or friend of the president, President Clinton at that time. So sometimes presidents will pardon people who clearly you can see have a close personal involvement with them, friends, family members, and they often do it on the last day of their presidency. Second term, they leaving office, it's released, and the president says nothing at all. So we've had, of course, the Gerald Ford press conference or announcement of Richard Nixon, and of course the Chelsea Manning one. But it's very hard to find presidents coming out in front of the press or in front of the American people saying, "I'm going to pardon so and so." It just does not happen, because often they know half of the country is going to be upset about it, and the other half will say, "Well, it's just about time. It should have been done earlier."
Right, and anyone listening can do this little experiment that Rick Brewer, our producer for this program, had to do, because we're looking for audio connected with this theme today. And if you try to search around for the internet, we found Obama, we found the Ford pardon. But otherwise, if you put presidential pardons there, you will get a bunch of turkeys. Yeah. That's what you will get.
That's true. I don't know that we have a statistic on how many turkeys have been pardoned. I think it goes back
to one every year since 1989. George H.W. Bush was the first president to pardon a turkey in honor of Thanksgiving.
And that has become such a media event in the meantime that has been loved by, seems every president to do it in his certain style here.
So I believe that when President Obama did it, he came forward and he said something to the effect of, you know, the presidency has so many great and awesome responsibilities, and this is not one of them.
We have about 10 minutes left with Rachel and Tim. In a couple minutes, I wanted to talk about the current occupant of the White House, but we have time beforehand to get to other former presidents who engaged in pardons. We haven't touched on Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan,
sure.
Pardoning Tim Walz for things having to do with what?
Well, for example, he did pardon George Steinbrenner for the boss, as he was called, the owner of the New York Yankees, for having made illegal contributions to Richard Nixon's presidential campaign. And so in many cases, you get some of these crimes where the individual who's pardoned didn't necessarily serve a prison term. So it's not as if everyone's being released from prison, but it was a black mark on Steinbrenner. And I think his friends wanted to make sure that he received a pardon for this unfortunate act of making that illegal contribution. I think he did that in the mid-80s. And again, it's an act of friendship on the part of President Reagan. Another one that he did that might surprise people is he pardoned Junior Johnson. So folks who are NASCAR fans will remember Junior Johnson, who actually was convicted and served time for having an illegal moonshine still. So back in the days before he was a famous race car driver, he was found guilty of moonshining and served time in prison for that. So, you know, in that sense, it's kind of rectifying, as Rachel said, an unfortunate illegality. And so those are two examples of, along with, you know, I suppose many, many others who most people don't know who they were.
With the exception of the current president, Rachel, do you want to point to any other pardons before we do get to Donald Trump?
Yeah, well, I think we think oftentimes about the politically motivated pardons, right? So we think about, for example, George H.W. Bush pardoning six individuals who had been involved in Iran-Contra, or we think about George W. Bush commuting the sentence of Scooter Libby, right? So there are certainly those examples where you look at politics and say, well, this is a political relationship and it makes sense. But I think what we don't pay attention to sometimes is the degree to which a president might use this power to make policy statements. And Barack Obama in particular really did this on his last day of office when he commuted the sentence of 330 individuals who had been convicted of nonviolent drug crimes. This is the largest number of commutations that have ever been delivered on one day, largest number of clemencies ever delivered on one day, more commutations than the prior 12 presidents combined. And so it was a really big statement, and was a statement that he wanted to make about the war on drugs and what was happening in our mass incarceration. You know, what was happening in our drug policy and how it was leading to mass incarceration.
The president shall have the power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment. That from the Constitution.
Right, exactly. Rachel's point, I think, is a very good one, where the president will, in effect, pardon a class. And Jimmy Carter, for example, pardoned those people who were resisted the Vietnam War, draft resistors who had gone to Canada or had otherwise committed a crime related to not being willing to serve. And what's been interesting is the Office of the Pardon Attorney occasionally hears from people now who are much older, as young people were pardoned for their draft resistance, had come back from Canada and so forth, and were seeking some sort of paperwork. And in many cases, these pardons, these general pardons, there isn't any specific document, there isn't a certificate that you get that says you're pardoned. So with classes, that effort to in effect, resolve the tension, the prevailing tension that continues to exist, is a general one. It's like absolution from sin. There isn't any certificate that goes with it.
Okay.
Wouldn't it be nice if there were, though?
Oh, we are a credential nation, Rachel, aren't we? We want a credential for everything.
That's right.
In the few minutes that we have remaining, Tim and Rachel, let's talk about the current occupant of the White House, Donald Trump. Rachel, you start us off with how this president has proved here, how many hundreds of ways has he proven himself to be unconventional and different than other presidents? Talk about this way.
Well, so first of all, by most accounts, the process has really shifted under President Trump. And so, you know, as we discussed earlier, in 1870, the earliest form of the Office of the Pardon Attorney came together, and that replaced a much more ad hoc process where individuals would send letters directly to the president requesting some sort of clemency. And it appears that in this White House, we've really returned to individuals appealing for clemency. People describe it as a freewheeling atmosphere where allies and aides and advisors come to the president and suggest an individual who might be a good choice for a pardon or a commutation. And that's a very, very significant change, a move away from the formalized process through the Office of the Pardon Attorney. And then one of the other trends that I would just note is that we have seen on at least two occasions, we have seen the introduction of celebrity appeals. So Kim Kardashian came to the White House and appealed to the president to, to offer a pardon to Alice Marie Johnson. And then Sylvester Stallone came to the president and asked on behalf of Jack Johnson a posthumous pardon.
Mm-hmm. Your comment.
Well, the great heavyweight champion, yes. And there's no controversy on those two. But the most recent batch, for example, pardoning Governor Blagojevich or Bernie Kerik or Michael Milken, these were controversial choices. And the New York Times, of course, has been covering this extensively over the time. And I think, for example, the Kerik pardon was kind of interesting because Kerik was at a low point. He had been the police commissioner in New York and had been convicted of crimes, I think tax evasion, and had served time for it and was finding it difficult to find work or anything else. And literally in February of this year, February 18th, he literally got a call, I think, from Congressman Peter King and said, I'm going to get you a pardon today. I mean, it's something to that effect. And within less than 10 hours, he had a pardon from the president. So this is, you know, we talk about going to Jiffy Lube for your oil change. My goodness, that was a pardon that went through faster than any I could possibly imagine. And it's, you know, it's well covered in the New York Times, documenting it almost day by day or hour by hour, I should say.
Just 2 minutes left of our conversation. I wanted to add this because in the final seconds here, you know, the questions about pardons that exist that have not been cleared up, I see perhaps one, a Donald Trump tweet from June of 2018. He said, I have the absolute right to pardon myself. Now, in that same tweet, he said, I'm not guilty of anything, but I have the absolute right to pardon myself. Is that an unanswered question here after so many years of our republic?
Rachel, you want to answer that one?
Well, this is a topic of considerable disagreement. There are some legal scholars who have proposed the idea that the president would be able to pardon himself, with the exception of impeachment. The Constitution is very clear that the pardon power cannot be used in cases of impeachment. But other than that, there are no constitutional limitations on the president's power to grant pardons.
Oh, yeah, exactly right. There's no prevailing law. There's no guidance from the Supreme Court on this issue. So the bottom line is the president could, in effect, pardon himself, and I suppose it might well be litigated. But this is also a president who wanted to know whether he could grant himself the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which is another question that I don't think anyone had ever given thought to. So there are ways and manners of doing things and questions that come up with this president that have never come up before.
Right. The president could maybe pardon himself. We know the vice president can because Gerald Ford was president when he did it. But the president,
that's right.
President could step aside and then be pardoned by the then president and perhaps take power again? I don't know.
You can come up with scenarios.
We have run out of time.
Okay.
a lot of scenarios that we can leave our listeners with. Thank you very much, Tim Walz, Director Emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. Rachel Payne Caulfield, Professor of Political Science at Drake University. It's been fascinating. Thank you both.
Good to be with you.
Thank you so much.
River to River is produced by Rick Brewer, Caitlin Harrop, and Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks so much for joining us.